industry has bought in return for its contributions to Trump's re-election. In short, U.S. foreign and national security policies will have a for sale sign out front. What will not fade away with a Trump win is the national embarrassment of having a criminal gang represent the U.S. abroad and in international organizations. Of course, that will hardly matter to autocratic governments, but it might well generate considerable mistrust among democracies. After all, if a U.S. decision is open to the highest bidder, and if the president is above the law and has a long history of fraudulent behavior, how good is the word of the United States of America? I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, Jill Freitas, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Today's episode is part one of a two-part interview with Rand Schenck, author of a fascinating and timely new history of the Forest Service, its founder Gifford Pinchot, and over 100 years of forest management and mismanagement in the Pacific Northwest. The book, Forest Under Siege, The Story of Old Growth After Gifford Pinchot, explores the Forest Service's progressive populist origins, how it abandoned its founding mission of conservation and drove our forests to the brink of extinction, and how or if the agency is entering a new restoration ecology era. Forest Under Siege is available at local bookstores throughout the Northwest, and you can order a copy online by searching for Forest Under Siege. Rand will also be giving a book reading at Powell's Books in downtown Portland at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, July 31st. Okay, let's get right into my conversation with Rand Schenck. Well, Rand Schenck, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on your book, Forest Under Siege, The Story of Old Growth After Gifford Pinchot. I learned so much. And one thing that I think is so great about this book, and I'm sure that you planned it just like this, is it is so relevant and timely to this moment. The Forest Service, as many of our listeners will know, is undergoing both a nationwide mature and old growth rulemaking process and revising the Northwest Forest Plan for the first time in its history. And this book couldn't have come out at a better time for those of us seeking to understand how to relate to those processes and how to think about such a large and complex federal agency. So thank you for that perfect timing.
I have to say, you know, I began this a number of years ago, and I never would have expected that actually the timing would work out so perfectly that it's coming out right at the time, as you say, that these two big amendment processes are underway.
Yeah, well, serendipity there. And I really hope and encourage listeners to get a copy of this book and read it now, because as I say, it's so timely and relevant. So just right up top, where do people find Forest Under Siege?
The book was published by Washington State University Press under their imprint Basalt Books. So certainly it can be ordered online through the WSU Press. The major bookstores are or will be carrying it. Powell's here in Portland, it would be a first place to go to.
Absolutely. And we'll have links to Powell's and any other places you want folks to go in our show notes in the podcast feed or at our website, coastrange.org. I have so many questions to ask you, and I thought we could start with a short reading from the book that you think might set the scene and give people a bit of a taste of what you're going for.
I'll just give a little framing in terms of the three phases that of the book that the forest that I cover about the Forest Service history. And let me just say this about the book as a whole. In many ways, it is a biography of a particular national forest, the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. And from that perspective, it's highly representative of every national forest throughout the Pacific Northwest. But I wanted to focus on a particular forest to really dig in deep what happened in that forest. And as I said, it's highly representative. So I look at examine three distinct phases that the Forest Service passed through. The first 40 years after the founding was the stewardship phase. Very little wood, very little timber came off the forest at that time throughout the Pacific Northwest. And then we enter the high production phase after World War II. And huge amounts of timber came off during that period. And then finally, we are now, after the Northwest Forest Plan was initiated in the early 90s, we're now in what I call the ecological management phase. So I want to, as a reading, I want to, one of the interesting phase changes was that movement from stewardship to high production. What was that about? I was really curious. You know, on average, the forest, the amount of timber that came off the national forest during those first 35, 40 years was just around 25 million board feet. And then the amount just started to increase very rapidly through the late 40s into the 50s and 60s. So I'll read a short piece about that transition. Just a little other, one other way to frame this is, during those first 40 years, each forest had an annual inspection report, and an outside auditor would come in and do a very thorough assessment of what's going on in the forest. And in this case, this outside auditor, L.K. Hayes, wrote the following. He was writing, first he said, "The Columbia National Forest, timber, water, recreation, and other values can contribute much to both local, regional, and national wealth." And that was really, those were his words, a quote from his inspection report. So he's really beginning to say, okay, there's a lot of timber resources in this forest that we can access. I go on to say, "We can see here the shift that was occurring within the Forest Service from valuing conservation as a first priority to valuing production and economic development as a first priority." Mays makes this transformation clear in his next paragraph, quote, "The job of managing the Columbia National Forest is rapidly changing from protection of an inaccessible virgin backwoods to the intensive management of forest lands adjacent to a heavily populated industrial zone." Again, those are his words. Just a note, the Columbia National Forest was renamed the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest in the late 40s. I go on to write just one more, a few things out of here. "Rarely does one encounter such an explicit description in the transformation of the culture of a federal agency. Two key phrases are distinctive in this general inspection, quote, inaccessible virgin backwoods, end quote, and, quote, intensive management, end quote. The first phrase was the on-the-ground reality that had existed not only for the first 40 years of the Forest Service's existence, but since time immemorial. The second phrase, intensive management, was not an on-the-ground reality, but rather an aspiration, if not a measurable objective. One reflected the past, the other the future."
Yeah, those prophetic words right there. And we're going to get into that whole shift. Let's step back and start at the beginning, though, if that's okay with you. Like you said, you focused on the Gifford Pinchot National Forest and Gifford Pinchot the Man, who is the founder of the U.S. Forest Service. And you also touched on already that this is also just a history writ large of the Forest Service, of the founding values, their shifting values and mission over the decades, and the self-image of the Forest Service and how those things have impacted the landscape. So let's start at the very beginning. Tell us a little bit about Gifford Pinchot, why you wanted to focus on him, and then we'll get into the agency that he created.
Sure. I'll go back to the first sentence of my book or phrase, which is a cabin in the woods. I have a cabin, a recreation cabin, that sits on the 1.3 million acres that takes up the Gifford Pinchot National Forest. And so I acquired that in the year 2000. And right off the bat, I was really curious, who is this guy, Gifford Pinchot? I, of course, knew of the name, but I really didn't have an understanding of who the man was, what his history was. And so I began to look into that, began to do some research, and through that research began to uncover the fact that he was and had quite an extraordinary lifespan and history over the first 45 years of the life of the Forest Service itself. Obviously, he was the first chief of the Forest Service beginning in 1905. So I wanted to understand who the man was, what his contributions were, and more about his legacy.
Like you, before reading this book, I didn't really know anything aside from the name. I knew he was the first chief and that he was controversial in conservation circles, to say the least, right? And so learning about him and the complexities around his life and philosophy was really fascinating and really helpful to provide context to what, you know, this agency that looms so large in the Pacific Northwest, especially because they manage so many acres there. So how did he come to create the Forest Service and be the kind of guiding light for it for so long?
Well, there's a fascinating history there. It actually in some ways began with his father, who was a wealthy man. His family and he grew up in Pennsylvania, and his father suggested to him that he should be a forester. And that was probably in response to the fact that much of their wealth derived from the practice of forestry. He was, in fact, the very first forester to practice forestry, working on what was the Vanderbilt estate in Western North Carolina. What really led to his being chief of the first Forest Service was a critical meeting he had with Teddy Roosevelt when Roosevelt was the governor of New York. There's a story there in the book, The Big Burn, where he met Teddy Roosevelt for the first time, and Roosevelt invited him to a wrestling match. So they actually became quite good friends, and he was hired in to work with the General Land Administration Agency. And when Roosevelt became president, and then asked him to, in 1905, to be the first chief of the Forest Service.
I love that anecdote that you tell in that book about Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt getting into a wrestling match at a party and then a boxing match. And just like, it seems like very classic for that time and place.
Classic for that time and place, unimaginable now.
Right. I would love for you to give us sort of an abridged timeline of the, as you already alluded to, the different phases of the Forest Service, and ground us in what were the founding values, what was the founding mission of the Forest Service, and then how did it come to become corrupted over time? My words, not necessarily yours.
Yeah, the founding mission was written by Pinchot that the Forest Service should provide the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run or the longest run. And that clearly, is a reflection of how powerful the progressive movement was at the time Pinchot became the chief of the Forest Service. It was really about working to address the monopolies and the wealth that was centered on a few people. I can read one quote that I think is highly reflective of Pinchot's philosophy. And the reason I want to read this quote also is because I think it's highly relevant for today.
Yeah, please.
He wrote, "Conservation is the most effective weapon against the monopoly of natural resources, and monopoly of resources is the basis for concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. In a democracy, that is the fundamental evil," end quote. And I think that it's just so highly prescient in terms of when he wrote that, and truly relevant to today.
Yeah, absolutely. So over time, you know, that mission shifted. Talk a little bit about that shift and how it occurred from this conservation mindset, which in the context of the book and the Forest Service and Gifford Pinchot, conservation has a different meaning than I think we think of it today. Maybe tell us the difference between conservation and preservation, and then we can kind of go back into the shifting mission of the Forest Service over the decades.
Yeah, I think the two people that represent those two philosophies and approaches are best really are John Muir on the preservation side and Gifford Pinchot on the conservation side. And the key distinction there is, from Pinchot's perspective, he put a tremendous emphasis on utilization of resources, whereas John Muir put tremendous emphasis on keeping it as it is, keeping the wild lands, the wild places, wild as they are. Yosemite was his first love, and that's really where he focused. And the example that where they really fell apart was the Hetch Hetchy controversy, where Hetch Hetchy Valley, right next to Yosemite Valley, was proposed to be flooded. And John Muir said, "No way. I never want, that's the corruption of the valley, of the natural lands, the landscape." And he fought hard against that flooding of his valley there. And Pinchot supported it. And the reason he supported it was he felt that it was really a need for water by San Francisco. And most of San Francisco burned up after the earthquake in the early 1900s. And part of the reason that most of the city burned down was a failure and lack of water. So from Pinchot's perspective, that utilitarian need overwhelmed the need for preservation. And there you have the encapsulation of really the distinction between both the two men on the one hand and the valuing of preservation versus the valuing of conservation and ultimately utility.
You write in the book that for the first 40 years or so of the Forest Service, the cut level was low. They did not favor clear cuts, instead selective harvest. And the idea was a sustained harvest of high quality timber, providing support to local communities in terms of jobs, providing for economic lumber so that, as you talked about, a progressive value so that people could afford to build their own houses and own their own houses. But also this emphasis on conserving resources, on protecting water quality, wildlife, et cetera, right? A very mixed use, multiple use conception. And that all changed around the 1950s. Talk about that moment of change and then lead us into what I would call the liquidation era, what you, I would say, diplomatically term the high production phase. So how did that change happen? And then talk about what that change wrought on the landscape.
Right. The change came about largely because let me go back and talk to the genesis or germ behind that change, which was that even beginning in the teens and in the 20s, a dominant belief that the Forest Service had at that time was that the forest itself, the natural forest, with all the old growth, you know, let's say 90% of it being old growth, needed to be eliminated, as you put it, needed to be liquidated. Some people call it the genocide of the forest, and certainly the death of the forest. And the reason for that, they felt that it needed to be replaced by a well-regulated, a young, vigorous, fast-growing, single-species, single-aged forest. And so that belief was there for years, for decades. They were unable to act on that belief until after World War II. And the primary reason for that was that the private timber industry, up until World War II, didn't want competition. They were happy to supply, and they had access to old growth. But by the time World War II came around, the old growth on private lands was pretty much gone. So they were ready to turn to the Forest Service to provide access to the old growth on Forest Service lands. So it was that was really the key shift there. One other piece was the Forest Service also felt erroneously that there was going to be a looming timber famine, and that never materialized. And partly that was the shift from the use of steel and concrete as opposed to wood resources. So that all set the conditions for this shift for the, quote, greatest generation after World War II to go into the woods and to eliminate, to liquidate the old growth so that we could replace it with a well-regulated, fast-growing, single-species timber plantation. That was what it's all about. And then you had three things come together. I call it the Iron Triangle. You had the executive branch happy to see economic development of the forest and money flowing into both the Forest Service and the both the local, state, and regional economies. So you had the administrative side of government, you had the legislative side, the Congress, happy to see those monies flowing into local, state, and regional economies. And then you had the timber industry. That was the third part of the Iron Triangle. Happy to have the jobs, happy to go in and cut the old growth. And so the two other pieces that undergirded that was who dominated the Forest Service. Two professions, silviculturists, who know how to grow and log, and engineers who know how to build roads and build bridges. Those two professions came together and the greatest generation went at it.
Yeah, I would love it if you could provide us with maybe a few statistics, numbers about just how much cut increased in the decades of 1960s through the 80s. And then I also wanted to touch on that road building as the, I can't remember who said it, but somebody's talked about the Forest Service as a road building agency that also logs. So, but give us a sense, especially maybe using, as you do in the book, the Gifford as an example of just the scale of where the cut was pre-World War II to what it peaked at.
Yeah, great. So for the 30, 40 years prior to the high production or liquidation phase, the cut averaged about 20 to 25 million board feet a year. Then beginning with World War II, the GIs come home, the demand for housing increases, and the cut went up to, on average, about 450 million board feet from 25 million board feet. And in fact, there were some years during the Great Depression that virtually no logs came off the national forest. And then, so from practically 1935, 1936, literally almost zero to the height in the 60s, over 700 million board feet off a year annually off this one national forest. On average for that 45-year period, close to about 450 million board feet a year. If you look at that, if we go to the highest point, that 700 million board feet of timber would build 70, just this is off just one national forest for 1 year, would build 70,000 homes. With the Northwest Forest Plan and the Spotted Owl that propelled that change, we came right back to where we were before World War II. And we're now, in the Gifford Pinchot, we're now around 25 to 30 million board feet a year. So it's a classic back to the future. And we can, in that way, look at, hopefully, this high production phase as an anomaly for what the U.S. Forest Service, in the Gifford Pinchot at least, is looking to do.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about that third phase, the post-Northwest Forest Plan iteration of the Forest Service. But I want you to underscore how unsustainable those harvest levels were, because as you write in the book, pre-liquidation phase or pre-high production phase, there was, and I'm forgetting the correct terminology, but the allowable cut is what was the sustainable harvest levels, and then there was the actual cut. And through a lot of that high production phase, they were going over what that sustainable cut level was, but they weren't just doing that out of malice. They were blinding themselves to the reality. So talk about how it got so out of whack and how these folks convinced themselves that the bubble was never going to burst.
Yeah. Great question. The two words that really apply here most directly are the ones I mentioned earlier: intensive management. Early on, the allowable cut, which they were early on, they treated that as a maximum never to be exceeded, because they did view that as the sustainable level of cut that could be maintained in perpetuity. But over time, as the pressures on the Forest Service to increase output, as those pressures increased, they just slowly increased the quote allowable cut. And so soon the transition was the allowable cut being something never to be exceeded to something to be achieved. So that was a real shift in itself.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece was, as a way of rationalizing this ever increasing, really over a period of several decades of quote allowable cut, where you go, the ecology of the forest didn't change, the landscape didn't change. How could it be that quote we can just keep cutting more and more and more? How could that be? Well, the rationalization was through intensive management. We can fertilize more. We can do thinning in a way that's going to enable an ongoing cut at the levels that we need. We can use herbicides. They kept coming up with different strategies for, quote, increasing the level of this intensive management. Over time, that led going from, 25 million board feet a year to up to 700 million board feet a year. But clearly, it was not sustainable. I will say this about the Forest Service at this time. They had research, but they just ignored the research. And truly, at least for sure in the 60s and into the 70s, they did not have a good understanding of the values that old growth provided in terms of particularly wildlife. They just simply ignore that. And so by ignoring that, they said, we can just continue to increase the cut level, and eventually we'll eliminate all the old growth and we'll be able to have, quote, a well-regulated, single species, even aged timber plantation, as opposed to a natural forest.
Thanks to the work of so many people, from kind of renegade scientists within the Forest Service's own ranks, scientists outside the Forest Service ranks, a mass forest defense movement, and then ultimately political pressure. That didn't happen, and we still have a little bit of native intact forest land left. Let's fast forward to the post-Northwest Forest Plan era, the current era of the Forest Service.
It really came about because of the Endangered Species Act. And so we have to go back to the key environmental legislation coming out of the Richard Nixon administration and the early 70s, the National Environmental Policy Act, the National Forest Management Act, and most importantly, the Endangered Species Act. And to cut to the chase, in 1991, Judge William Dwyer out of Seattle said to the Forest Service in a very emphatic way, stop, you're breaking the law. He issued an injunction that put a halt to virtual all logging in the Pacific Northwest, but specifically all logging of public lands where spotted owls were found. And that virtually was, at the time, throughout the Pacific Northwest. And that was reverberated just an extraordinary moment where the whole industry was shut down. And the result of that then led to the Northwest Forest Plan. those who were around in the early 90s will recall that then President Clinton, it was in the first couple of months of his administration, brought together the key stakeholders in Portland. And out of that, two days of his in his administration, out of that came ultimately the Northwest Forest Plan.
And that's all we have time for on this episode of Coast Range Radio. We will be back in 2 weeks with part two of my interview with Rand Schenck. In the second half of that conversation, we talked about whether we can trust the current iteration of the Forest Service, how they could do a better job of acknowledging and repairing the agency's past harms and misdeeds, and most importantly, how to engage in the public pressure campaign to force the Forest Service to permanently protect old growth and mature forests. So make sure to tune in to the next episode of Coast Range Radio on your local community radio station or subscribe to the Coast Range Radio podcast feed. Until then, thank you so much for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.